Welcome to Belfast City Vineyard, where we are pursuing formation in the presence of Jesus, community gathered around him, and the impact he empowers us to bring in our families, city, and the world. The following message was given at one of our Sunday services. For more information, visit our website at belfastcityvineyard.com.
This morning I want to talk about being a disciple of Jesus. It will come as no surprise that we're going to talk about Jesus. My sister has a running joke that every time I'm asked to speak, sooner or later I effectively end up talking about the same thing. And we're going to go there again today. We're talking about Jesus. And specifically moving from a member of the crowd to being a disciple. So last week, if you remember, Alan talked about the rich young man who came to Jesus and went away sad because the advice was, sell everything you have, give it to the poor. And he couldn't do that or wouldn't do that. And Peter has heard this and is a bit stressed because he's kind of concerned that he wants to be in and make sure that he's okay. So he says, but Jesus, we left everything to follow you. And Jesus says, don't worry, anyone who left fathers or mothers or sisters or brothers or homes for me will effectively get a reward in this life and the life to come. So it's okay. And you can imagine the crowd and the disciples are relieved because it's all right. Their sacrifice is noted. They're going to be rewarded. Jesus has noticed. And especially the disciples, because they have literally left everything for Jesus. And that's all true. The life for the age to come is for now and eternity, and there'll be reward for faithful disciples, and it's marked with goodness and blessedness and really, really wonderful things. But today, the passage we're going to read in Luke chapter 18 is where Jesus takes the disciples aside, and he tells them that he's going to go to the cross, and he's going to pay a huge cost. Okay? And both revelation is true. So what he told the crowd about reward for disciples and in this life and the life to come, that's true. And what he tells the disciples when he takes them aside, that it's going to involve the cross, that's true as well. It's just this idea that the disciples heard more and they got a different understanding of what was really going on. So today we're talking about moving from crowd to disciple. So we're in Luke 18, verses 31 to 43. And it says, Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He will be delivered over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, and spit on him. They will flog him and kill him. On the third day, he will rise again. The disciples did not understand any of this. Its meaning was hidden from them, and they did not know what he was talking about. Okay, so whenever I read a Bible passage or begin to prepare or in my own time, usually there's like one word or one phrase or one tiny bit of the story that I kind of, it rumbles around in the back of my mind or the back of my heart. And for me, I read this to begin to prepare about a month ago. And the bit that has rumbled around in my head is this bit, Jesus took the 12 aside. That little phrase, just those five words. And I would really like that to be a reality in my life. Okay, this happens again and again in the Gospels. The crowd hear all of Jesus' teaching, or lots of it. They see miracles. They get to go along and follow him around. But there's some things that are just for the disciples. And I've been thinking this week, what does it mean to be one who's taken aside by Jesus and just hear like deeper revelation or fuller revelation? There was always this pattern of revelation up until the time of Jesus, where God revealed himself maybe to one person or a prophet, and they relayed God's message to the people. In fact, it says in Hebrews 1 verse 1, in the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. So for us, God has spoken like definitively once and for all through Jesus. And we now know what God is like in a fuller way because we've seen Jesus. And through Jesus, we all get to come near. So it's not like the past where God spoke to your prophet and they passed the message on. It's not like those days where a man will teach his father or someone. I'm going to completely murder this verse because I haven't written down. They will all know me. It's basically the gist of it. We all get to come close. God has spoken and there's an invitation. And it's not comparative or competitive as to who gets to be a disciple of Jesus. Okay? But the thing that I've been thinking about this week is there's still a pattern of revelation even for us today where some people get to know Jesus more than others. Okay? Have you ever met somebody and you just know that they've been in the presence of the Lord and they've probably spent a good part of their whole lives on it? Like you can just tell. There's something about it. you can tell that Jesus has shaped something in their lives in little ways and big ways over a whole lifetime. So there's still a choice for all of us as to whether we want to be part of the crowd or whether we want to and go along and see miracles and be part of something significant and part of a people, or whether we want to be one who's chosen to count the cost again and again and follow as a disciple and give our wholehearted allegiance to Jesus. I have a quote by a guy called Richard Foster, and it says, "Superficiality is the curse of our age. The doctrine of instant satisfaction is the primary spiritual problem. The desperate need today is not for a greater number of intelligent people or a greater number of gifted people, but for deep people." Okay? And I think how we get to be deep people is we respond to Jesus when he invites us to come aside with him, and we're shaped by him in little ways and big ways in the secret place. And it might look like time in our diary set aside. So you might set aside half an hour in the morning, or a day a week, or a retreat time in the summer. It might look like time in our diary set aside, but it will also look like every other bit of our day being filled with the presence of the Lord too. Okay? So this is not a bit of the talk where I'm saying we should all have a quiet time. Although, if you want to be a disciple of Jesus, you just have to spend your time reading your Bible and praying and worshipping and listening to him. Like, we just do. But actually, a person who's taken aside by Jesus, as opposed to a member of the crowd, it's not like they'll do 30 minutes in the morning and then they'll be done. Okay? They might do 30 minutes in the morning in the quiet with their Bible. Then they'll go to work, and they'll hear from the Lord in work, and they'll worship him when they're in the car on the way home, and they will interact with people, understanding that every person they meet carries something of the Lord, carries something of his image. And they'll go through their whole day with worship breaking out in normal life, because if we're a disciple, we actually don't have any normal life anymore. There's no split between the sacred bit of our lives and the secular bit of our lives. For disciples, there's no normal life outside of the presence of God. He's the Lord, and he claims all, like 24/7, 365 days a year. And the scary and exciting thought for me this week has been, what if the limiting factor on how well I know Jesus on the earth, what if the limiting factor is how much I want to? Like, God has done everything. He has invited us. He has invited all of us. He's spoken once and for all through Jesus. And the invitation is for all of us to come near and choose to be part of, like, close as disciples. But something is required of us. Being a disciple is a response to what God has done. But it's not passive. So why don't we? Why do we stand back and stay in the crowd and follow from a distance and watch all the exciting things but not go aside with Jesus? We can get as much as we can handle. We can get as much as we are hungry for. And yet quite often we don't ask, we don't seek. Relationship with the maker of heaven and earth is what we're offered. We can go aside with this Jesus. And I wanted to read Colossians 1. And I find this interesting because those of you who were here last week will know Alan also read from Colossians 1 last week. And we didn't compare notes. Like, I'd already made a note that I was going to do this before I heard Alan speak last week. And we're preaching through Luke 18. We're nowhere near Colossians 1. But 2 weeks in a row, two different people have ended up here. So I just think it's interesting. So I'm going to read it. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. And why did I read that? Well, the reason is, why on earth would we not spend our lives on that? Like, why on earth would we stay in the crowd if this is who Jesus is? Like, if you fill your hearts and minds with a picture of who Jesus is in his fullness, like, the fullness of God dwells in him. So for me, if I change the conversation to thinking about Colossians 1, then of course I want to be taken aside by Jesus. Of course I want to move from the crowd to being a disciple. So how do we get near? How do we get taken aside by Jesus? Well, firstly, it's invitation. Jesus gathered them. He called them individually. He gathered them and he invited them away with him again and again. So our job as disciples is to respond in the big things and the little things and learn how to count the cost and be obedient. We need to learn what the voice of the Lord sounds like. And we do that by, well, there's loads of ways, the spiritual disciplines through the ages. The church have gone to again and again as ways to learn what the voice of the Lord sounds like and to practice obedience. We read our Bibles, we worship, we talk to people who know what the voice of the Lord sounds like and spend time with them so it rubs off on us. And when we hear him speak, we respond. So if he invites us to come away, then we listen and we don't drown it out. Have a little example. I had a different example, but this morning a new thing happened. So this week has been a bit of a busy week. I'm sure we could all say that for lots of different reasons. We went on holiday, then we came home and all got a vomiting bug. So we spent the week doing that. We're all well again. And then it was my parents' 40th wedding anniversary. In fact, they're here. How exciting. They snuck in and I didn't realise. So my parents are 40 years married. Isn't that amazing? Yes. Yeah. It's just... So we got, like, the big party last night. We got balloons and, you know, it's just awesome. So we had a big party last night, lots of organisation. Kids stayed, the point of the story is the kids stayed up till 10:30, right? My children do not sleep in, okay? But 10:30 at night means they're probably going to go past 6:30 in the morning. In fact, they didn't start till about 9:00. Like, that's like a little bit of heaven on earth, right? Okay, so that's to set the scene. I'm going to get a lie-in. So at about 7 o'clock this morning, I woke up. And I just woke up, and I was just very, like, I literally, and this is not me, I wake up thinking, how on earth can it be morning? I'm not getting up, right? But I woke up, and the first thing that crossed my mind was, man alive, Jesus is pretty wonderful, right? And the only way I can describe it is there's this verse in the Psalms that says, but I, in righteousness, I will see your face. When I wake, I will be satisfied with seeing your likeness, or something like that. And I felt like that's what happened. Like, I woke up, and as I awoke, it was like he was in the room, and there was just a sense of, oh, the presence of the Lord is wonderful, and I'm just so happy to be here, right? And I spent about 5 minutes just lying there thinking, Lord, I'm really, really, this is precious and wonderful. And then I thought, this is awesome. I now have an hour to go back to sleep, right? Because the kids won't be up. And then I had a wee niggle of, I don't know if the Lord woke me up so I could go back to sleep. I probably should get up and go downstairs and prepare. Like, I had prepared, but, you know, take some time, read through it again, spend some time with him in peace. But my bed is very comfortable, and I live under grace, not legalism, and the Lord really likes sleep, so maybe, you know. And I did that for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then I got up, and I went downstairs. And the reason why I tell you that is because that was an invitation which was very precious, and I'm loved, and had I chosen to go back to sleep, I don't think the world would have ended. But there was a little stirring of, Cathy, you should get up now, and you should go and spend some time with him. And how we choose in those little moments... Like, he loves us either way, but we build momentum of obedience or momentum of disobedience and a momentum towards responsiveness or the other way. And that's what being disciple looks like in the tiny little ways, just choosing to respond. The other thing about being a disciple is we don't compare, okay? There's actually more than enough of Jesus and his presence to go around. This is something I forget. Sometimes I think that if one of you gets really close to the Lord and is having an amazing experience with him, that maybe threatens me. I don't know if I should admit this, you know, because it's sort of the sense of, well, if they're getting it, I'm not, and they're the chosen one and I'm not. But actually, Jesus and his presence is infinite, so there is more than enough to go around, and we are all beloved and secure. So if, for example, Andy's in America, if he absolutely nails it, and is like, which he is, and is getting really close to Jesus, and the Lord's favor is on him, and he's hearing things and growing in faith, that is only good for me. As another member of the body of Christ, that is only a good thing. It should make my faith grow, not make me feel inferior or worried that I'll miss out because somebody else is getting. So there is no limit. We can all be disciples. We can all be taken aside by Jesus. We can all spend all of our energy and affection and attention on him for eternity, and there will be infinity left over. Okay? So we don't need to worry about our little patch. The crowd saw and heard amazing things. They would have been people whose lives were changed forever in the crowd, but the disciples were taken aside by Jesus. Okay, they got deeper revelation. They got to know him more. So that's the first 5 verses. I'm going to go a bit quicker now. After he took them aside, what does he tell them? He tells them, no. Oh, yes. We are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. I really like this because he says, we are going to Jerusalem. And there's no I anymore. And I just find that really funny, like we're doing this. They don't get a vote, okay? Jesus called them and they responded. They were all invited individually. They all had a choice. And the disciples all have a choice to walk away at any point. In fact, there were other followers of Jesus, not one of the 12 disciples, but other followers who at points in the Gospels chose to go back to their normal lives. They just went home again. And we all know that Judas, one of the 12 disciples who was taken aside here, chooses to walk away and betray Jesus while he does it. So disciples can walk away at any point and go back to their normal lives. Like, we always have a choice. But if we stay with Jesus and we're disciples of his, then we just don't get a vote. It's not a democracy. I'm a beloved child. I can pour out my heart to him, and it is precious worship. I can pray and ask for what I need. For some reason, the Lord has even set it up that my prayers can release his power on the earth. So, like, our voice really, really matters, and we're deeply significant, but we also don't get a vote. God is the king, and I follow him. So as disciples, we are the followers, and we are always the followers. And we have to remember that if we're to be people who are taken aside by Jesus, that he calls the shots. Okay? And he tells them again what's going to happen to him. Everything that's written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. And he even, like, he knew it all, even down to the detail that they are going to spit on him. Like, just that, couldn't get my head around that this week, that Jesus went into it fully knowing down to the detail what faced him. He didn't have his life taken from him, he laid it down. And if you remember back to last week, this is in response to Peter saying, Lord, we left everything for you. Kind of like, just remember that, Jesus. I've given up a lot. Maybe you owe me, or you need to come through for me. And Jesus is gently showing in these verses that actually he's going to give up a lot too. In fact, much, much more. And he doesn't owe the disciples anything. So in Jesus' description of the Passion, he calls himself the Son of Man. Okay, and it's a title he often uses for himself. So other people call him Son of David, as we'll see, or other things. He calls himself Son of Man quite often, often in places where he's talking about his suffering or his resurrection and the fact he's going to come again. And it sounds to us at first reading that Son of Man means he's a human, so it's emphasizing his humanity. But actually, there's a passage in Daniel 7 where there's this messianic figure, one like a son of man, or it maybe should be translated one like a human, comes before the Ancient of Days, so comes before God. And it says, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Okay? So when Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, it's not just about how he's human. This is who the Son of Man is. Like, this powerful figure who's going to rule everything. So it's maybe a little bit about that he's human, but also about his divinity as well. And specifically the way that his divinity is going to be revealed through suffering, which was the bit the disciples didn't understand. This is the bit they get stuck on again and again and again. It seems obvious to us now, but the disciples didn't understand. Okay? They're his chosen friends. They've spent the most time with him. They're the ones he repeatedly took aside, and they don't understand. That actually really comforts me, that we're just not going to understand everything. The Lord loves to reveal himself to us. He's called a revealer of mysteries in one place. But there's still things I'm not going to understand. And this is the bit of deep discipleship that I've been learning recently, that if we're to be people taken aside by Jesus, then we have to lay down even control of the process. Okay? I'm the follower and he's the master. So I have another quote. This is my favorite quote of the last year in any book I read. Spiritual formation is the great reversal from habitual expectation of closure to patient, open-ended yieldedness. I just think it's fab. We think there should be 10 steps to discipleship. So I'm talking about being taken aside by Jesus and moving from crowd to disciple. And I could give you 10 steps, and it would be good if they all started with the same letter. So it would all, you know, be snazzy. That's not my style. It can be really, really helpful, but, you know. There aren't 10 steps. There aren't even measurable results, okay? Discipleship is not like that. There should be fruit. There should be change in your life and the lives of those around you when you follow Jesus, but there will be, because he's Jesus. So he'll do the changing. But we aren't in charge, and sometimes we don't understand, and we practice patient, open-ended yieldedness, even when he tells us things that make no sense. So the disciples didn't understand, and sometimes we won't either. But actually, we live in different times to they did. Okay, so Jesus is talking here about how he's going to go up to Jerusalem, and he's going to be killed, and he's going to rise again. And all the places where it talks about mystery in the New Testament, or things the disciples didn't understand, it's nearly always around this idea that yes, the king is coming, yes, God is bringing rescue, yes, the day of the Lord is at hand, but the king is going to die. And that is the bit they just didn't understand over and over and over again. And the other bit to the mystery that's talked about, that's now been revealed to us, is the fact that it wasn't just for the Israelites. It was going to be, the Gentiles were going to be invited in too. So those are the two things the disciples didn't understand. Yes, the king has come, but he's going to die. And he's bringing in a kingdom where Gentiles are invited in as well and are grafted into the people of God. So the reason why I'm saying that is because if you want to grow as a disciple and be taken aside by Jesus, this is the mystery that the prophets long to understand, and we get to. Like, we understand. We know what Jesus has done. We know he came to bring a new people. So if you want to grow as a disciple, that would be a good place to start. The revelation of what Jesus did on the cross, which the disciples didn't understand, but actually we do. So after he takes them aside, they're walking to Jericho, and they meet a blind man. So as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. When he came near, Jesus asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" "Lord, I want to see," he replied. Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight, your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God. Okay, so this is a story of a blind man who is healed. And in the story in Mark, we read that the man's name is Bartimaeus, which can apparently also be translated as son of filth, which I just can't get my head around. But anyway, so that's his label. It's quite shocking. And as a child, like if you were to say to me the name Bartimaeus, I know he's blind. That's pretty much the only thing I know about this man, because the label of what had happened to him had been attached to who he is, to the point where 2,000 years later, the only thing we know about Bartimaeus is that he's blind. And it got me thinking about identity and how we mark people and how we decide this is who you are and these are the markers that go with you, and what things we stick on ourselves. So it's almost like, yes, he had a physical disability or physical condition that meant he couldn't see, but probably that exterior thing had settled into his heart at some level from being excluded and being on the outside and being called son of filth, to the point where it becomes a heart thing as well as a physical thing. You probably hit the point where you can't know how there's ever going to be a way to get past that. There's a little kid's book, I can't remember the name of it, but it's about little wooden creatures called Wemmicks. And basically, they're made by a carpenter called Eli. And they're little wooden people, and they walk around all day, and they have stickers. And if you do something good, like say you were really kind to somebody, you might get a gold star. And you know, Wemmicks just wear them all over themselves, gold stars. And if you do something bad, if you're mean or hurt someone's feelings, you get a black dot to show that you did something wrong. But also, for example, if you do a somersault and you fall over, so you didn't do anything bad, you just failed, you get a black dot. And Wemmicks walk around with gold stars and black dots, and that's how you know who are the good Wemmicks and who are the bad Wemmicks. Okay? And basically, one wee Wemmick ends up going to see the maker. He ends up in the carpenter's room, and he ends up talking about the stickers. He says, "I met this Wemmick once, and she has no stickers. Why does she have no stickers?" And the carpenter says, "The stickers only stick if you let them. That little girl has decided that she cares more what her maker thinks about her than what the other Wemmicks think about her, so the stickers can't stick, they just fall off," right? And every time I read this with my kids, I end up bawling my lumps out. Because there's a bit whenever the little Wemmick is leaving, and Eli says, "Come back and see me soon, the maker," and then a sticker falls off him. Oh, man. Yeah, so it's just a lovely wee book. But the point is, we all do this. We stick stickers on ourselves, or we stick stickers on other people. So the rich young man last week came to Jesus with all his gold stars. "Look at all my stickers, Jesus. I've kept all these commandments since I was young. I have so many gold stars. I should be acceptable." The blind man, or plenty of others we've seen throughout Luke, are at a distance, and they have black dots on them, whereby society has said, there is something about you that means you are less than acceptable and you should be far away. And Jesus doesn't really care about our gold stars or our black dots. He's shown that the things we bring to him to say, "This is my gold star, look how good I am." It's like, that isn't really what makes you good. But I love you, and I'm here for you. And the same with the black dots. The stickers lose their stickiness. So time aside with Jesus as a disciple of his will mean that both our little gold stars and our black dots fall off. And blind Bartimaeus, where that was the thing that I remember about him by the end of the story, is just Bartimaeus. Like, Jesus has dealt with the things that have got stuck onto him. Keeping an eye on the time. So Bartimaeus calls out for mercy. And a lot of the time in the Gospels, when people call out to Jesus from the margins, it's for mercy. That's the cry to Jesus. And it's actually been a prayer I've been praying a lot over recent months. And for me, the reason why it's been important is when you pray for mercy, you remember who's got the power and who doesn't. Okay? Sometimes I come to God as if he owes me. Bartimaeus is under no illusions that Jesus owes him healing. He just cries out for mercy. And the thing with Jesus is, again and again in the Gospels, whenever people cry out, especially from the margins, for mercy from Jesus, is that he stops. Okay? And the crowd react by telling him to be quiet. In fact, in Mark's Gospel, they effectively tell him to shut up. Okay, so he's at the back, and he's crying out, and they tell him to shut up. And he cries out again. And that level of desperation, that level of determination to see Jesus, no matter what the cost, no matter what everyone around is doing, that leads to a response in Jesus, whereby he stops and he honors this man in front of the whole crowd. He's singled out and brought to the front. In fact, the crowd, Jesus says, "Bring him to me," like he's brought. So it's almost like the crowd who were keeping him out have to then carry him into the presence of Jesus. Would Jesus have stopped if he hadn't cried out? I don't know, but he probably wouldn't have. Like, a lot of the time Jesus is interrupted, and we've seen before that he is easily interrupted by people who need his mercy, but it starts with the person crying out for what they need. And Jesus stops and asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" Okay, is the blind man ready for a complete change of life? Because everything is going to be different. And his answer is simple: "Lord, I want to see." And in the same way that, you know, taken aside by Jesus, the words went round and round in my head, these words did too: "Lord, I want to see." Okay? For some of us, the thing we want or need from the Lord is that simple. Like, it's not a big, long thing. It's not pages and pages. It's not complicated. It's literally just, there's one thing, Lord, and I am stuck, and I cannot get away past this outside of the rescue of the Lord. Okay? It's a huge thing where we can't fix it, and we're at the end of ourselves, and we need mercy from Jesus. And I just felt, if there's some of us here like that today, where there is one thing and we've been waiting for a long time, then there's an invitation to ask again. And Jesus heals him, and immediately he received his sight. And like, I don't know about you, but I really want to see some immediately's, because there's things I've been praying for a long time. And like, the Lord does things slowly and also really quickly. And he works over generations, and he also moves immediately. And we as disciples, we practice patient, open-ended yieldedness. So I am not the boss. He is. But sometimes King Jesus moves immediately and power comes and the kingdom breaks out. And someone who could not see can see immediately. And I just am standing in faith that the things I'm waiting for, sooner or later, after maybe months or years or days or however long of prayers, then will come the immediately moment when and immediately the thing that we'd asked for happened. And then Jesus says, "Your faith has healed you." Okay? And I think the last time I was speaking, this phrase was in it as well. And it's always a tricky one, "Your faith has healed you," because then I'm left thinking, well, the things I'm praying for, maybe I just need to have more faith, and then they'll happen. Maybe it's my fault that my prayers aren't being answered. And I've been thinking about faith and what it's like. And as I've been pondering it, it's like Bartimaeus had faith on three levels, and probably many more. Okay, so he has faith that Jesus has the power to heal him. He has faith that Jesus has compassion on the poor and the excluded, including him. And he has faith that Jesus is the Son of David, the long-promised king who was going to come and establish the rule and reign of God forever. Okay? And because all those things are true, because Jesus has the power to heal and he has compassion and he is the son of David, then of course a blind man is able to see again. Okay? It's interesting for me, if I'm struggling to pray for something or if I'm feeling really stuck about something, sometimes I ask God, which bit do I not believe? Like, which bit of the situation do I not understand? So maybe I believe that, yes, he could heal a blind man. Yes, he could heal me in the thing that I need power for. But maybe I've forgotten that he doesn't forget people or overlook them. Maybe I think that I'm the one who's destined to be on the outside. Or maybe I know that he has compassion and I know that he cares about me, but I've forgotten that he's the king of the world and he has all power and all authority. So there are lots of ways that our faith or what we believe about God can get distorted very slightly, and we end up with places where we think things are unchangeable, but they're contrary to the will of God, and nothing is unchangeable if it's contrary to the will of God. So it's either all true or none of it is. We are moving to England. Some of you maybe know this, some of you maybe don't. We are moving to England in a few months' time, and I got myself in a tizzy. That's a bit of an understatement, about primary schools and where to live, and pretty much primary schools and where to live. And I was up till 3 o'clock one night over what are we going to do, and we're, you know, constant. And I woke up in the morning with this moment of clarity of either Jesus is the king of the world or he isn't. And if he is, then firstly, there's way bigger issues than primary schools, but he also cares about that, and he can move in power, and my children are safe. And if it's not true, then I've got way bigger problems. No, so it's all or nothing. We believe all of it, or our faith begins to crumble. I was on a treasure hunt this week. This is my last story, and then I'm nearly done. I was on a treasure hunt this week. I got Serena's permission to tell this story. So we went to Donaghadee, and we went. It had 24 clues, and we took the girls to go hunting for... Well, it's not treasure. You just get the success of finishing the hunt, which is awkward when you take a four-year-old with you, because I was trying to manage expectations of, no, Cleo, there's no treasure, honey. We just get to the end, and we've answered the clues. So we were driving around. There were 22 or 24 clues. To give you a bit of context, we got 7, and then we gave up and went for ice cream. Right? And of the 7, we actually only got 5 we had to skip to, because we just... It was, and Serena and I hit the point of near hysteria on the streets of Donaghadee, where we just were sitting on the ground laughing till we cried. It's just, this was a quiz for 8-year-olds, and we couldn't do it. So, and it, we should have known it wasn't going to go well because we couldn't find the starting point for the quiz. So we were driving around Donaghadee, unable to find the car park, which was the beginning. And there's the beginnings of, yeah, this really isn't going to go well. Like, should we just give up now and go for coffee? And Serena said, as we were driving around, she said, I have faith, right? And it was sort of half a joke and a throwaway remark, okay? But it was funny because did she mean I have faith that we're going to be able to do this? Because all evidence to the contrary, we were not able to do this, not in our wildest dreams. It was supposed to take an hour and a half. At an hour and a half, we were on 6. And it was, okay. Now, Serena is a woman of faith, so I actually know what she believes. Like, she is a woman of deep faith. If you know my sister, you'll know she believes in King Jesus and his kingdom, and she believes in people. So it's not a glib remark with Rena, like, she has faith, okay? But because I was preparing this, whenever she said, I have faith, I thought, well, it's still not going to go very well. And it also reminded me of all those times, it's always struck me whenever people say, have faith, okay, or I have faith. Because I always think, well, what exactly does that mean? Like, what do you mean, have faith? Faith isn't some entity on its own, okay? Now, we are people of faith. I believe the reason why humanity believes things is because we're made in the image of God and he's made us like that. So we're made to have faith. We're made to believe things, but it actually matters what our faith is in, okay? And when I think about it, I think of, we've seen those coasters or posters where there's a kitten falling off a branch, like with one little hand, and it says, hold on and have faith. Like, well, what does that mean? Am I having faith that a kitten can climb up a tree? Because it probably can, but that doesn't do me any good. And I actually mentioned this to Rena last night, and she pointed out that kittens are always funny, so they always make your life better, even if that's the only purpose. But it was just this weird thing of, what does this mean, have faith? You know? And is it that if I'm stuck falling off a branch, I should have faith in myself that I'll be able to climb back up again? Self-belief. Appropriate self-belief is actually really important, and faith in ourselves is important, but sometimes I'll be like a little kitten falling off a branch and I will not be able to climb back up with the best will in the world. Okay? So, have faith. It's something where it's like we have faith that the world will be good, or faith that it'll all work out in the end, or faith that people will be nice to us. That's all garbage. Like, it's all a smokescreen. It doesn't mean anything. It will let you down. Faith isn't some... The only way I can describe it is like a cloud, like some nebulous, generic thing about some generic good force. It's not what faith is. So whenever Jesus said, your faith has healed you, Bartimaeus had specific faith in Jesus. Okay? We have faith in Jesus, who loved us and gave himself for us. We have faith that Jesus is the long-promised Son of David, that he comes with power and authority, and sickness and death bow the knee before him. We need to know who our faith is in. Okay, we're a people of faith, but not like kittens falling off trees faith. We have faith in Jesus. Okay? And some of us, when we read stories like this, we struggle to have faith. We think, I should have more faith. I should believe more. And you can't faith up. As Alan would put it, like, you just, that doesn't work. We don't try to have more faith. We remember who our faith is in, and then faith grows. So the fact that Colossians 1 came up 2 weeks in a row, if you want more faith, spend days or weeks or months reading Colossians 1 and thinking about who Jesus is, and of course your faith will grow. Okay? We need to know what we believe. Our faith is not a set of ideals or a religious doctrine. We have faith in a person, and if we're stuck, maybe we write down what we believe to be true, what we know to be true about Jesus, and read it and reread it and go over and over and over again until faith, specifics of our faith, are drilled so deep down into our hearts that they're just unshakable. And I think our faith will grow. So today we were reading through Luke 18. We went on a meandering tour through Luke 18, I'm sure you'll agree. But the things I was talking about were how disciples are taken aside by Jesus and they come close. And those who are taken aside by Jesus and count the cost and go away with him actually get a deeper revelation and a deeper understanding of who Jesus is than those who stay in the crowd. And they will also pay a cost. And it will be worth it because of who Jesus is. Also was thinking about miracles, and specifically those of us who it's one giant thing and we know what we need, and we need mercy desperately, and we would really love it to be immediately today. And then the last thing was, I just felt like there's some of us here where we need faith, and we've been trying really hard to have faith and to make ourselves have faith. And I just thought we were to pray for you today, to bless you to have faith and to pray for faith to come, but to also for revelation of Jesus. So faith will grow as we see Jesus more, not as we focus on trying to have more faith. So could you all please stand? And could those of you who are trained to pray on the prayer ministry team please come up to the front and get ready to pray for people? When I was praying this morning, having finally decided to get up early, I asked the Lord, what was I to pray at the end? And I felt like, in terms of discipleship and being taken aside by Jesus, that there's a phrase that I've had in my head and heart for weeks and months, and it's above all else, Jesus. And I felt that that was what I was to pray over us, that we would be people whereby it's above all else, Jesus. Okay, so let's pray and then we'll be done. And if you'd like to get ministry, you're welcome to. So, Jesus, we thank you that you're the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. We thank you that in everything you have the supremacy. And Lord, I thank you for what you've done with me, where you've taught me that it is above all else, Jesus. Right now, I release this over my brothers and sisters, that it's above all else, Jesus. And I pray you do a new thing in our hearts, that we would know something has been branded into us. Above all else, Jesus. And I pray that deep discipleship and faith will grow. Yeah. So Jesus, would you be honored? Would you go with us? And would your presence linger on us through this week? In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening to this message. For all the latest information about what's happening in the life of our church, or if you have any questions or comments, head over to BelfastCityVineyard.com.